During our lifetimes, we've seen so much technology change, from the PC to the internet, mobile, and the cloud. And today, we're in the middle of an AI platform shift, but the path forward isn't always easy or clear. Welcome to Leading the Shift, a new podcast for Microsoft Azure. I'm your host, Susan Ettlinger, and I've been watching this space unfold for the past decade plus. We'll speak with the folks who are figuring out this new era of technology. We'll hear their stories, their personal experiences, their challenges, what they're learning, and what advice they have to help you chart your own path. And now, here's our first episode. Drop us a comment to let us know what you think, and stay tuned for more episodes coming soon. Data is everywhere. Data-driven products, data-driven services, data-driven business models. But we're going to kick off with a story about an organization that's using data and AI to build an entirely new field, data for social impact. Today, my guest is Perry Hewitt, Chief Marketing and Product Officer of Data.org. We're going to talk about the approaches that they and the organizations they support are using to solve some of our world's greatest challenges. And, spoiler alert, many of them are just as relevant for business. A little bit about Perry. She's held marketing, digital product, and strategy roles at Bloomberg Philanthropies, Lincoln Center for the Performing Arts, and before joining Data.org, Perry served as Harvard University's chief digital officer. So I'm thrilled to have her as our first guest. Perry, welcome to Leading the Shift.
Susan, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
So tell me a little bit about Data.org.
So Data.org was founded in 2020 by the Rockefeller Foundation, the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth. And the vision was the private sector has for decades benefited from the use of data to apply to problems, and the social sector is lagging woefully behind. So how do we begin to think about forming an organization that can act as a platform for partnerships, bringing together philanthropy and academia and social impact organizations and government in order to build a new field of data for social impact?
So yeah, let's kind of get into that, because I think this question of what do we do now? I mean, it's been, 2 years or so since ChatGPT came on the scene, and you know, tons of stuff has happened, not just at Microsoft and at data.org, but all over the world surrounding data, surrounding AI, cloud technologies. And you know, one of the things that was so interesting to me when we first started talking was this idea that, yes, you can apply data to products, you can apply it to services, and so on, but like you're creating an entirely new discipline built on data. So let's talk about that. What is data for social impact?
So data for social impact is taking the use of data and AI and applying it to the world's most challenging problems. And what makes it different? I think the nature of data for social impact is involves more interdisciplinarity. We've decided we don't want only a technology-first solution to all these problems. We want to think about who's in the room and how are those decisions being made, not just the what, but the who and the how. So that's a big part of data for social impact. And it's something that we work on in concert with the people who are most affected by the data. So I think there's a lot of community involvement, and there are a lot of new jobs and capabilities. I co-wrote a paper on the idea of having a data ecosystem designer, which is sort of a new kind of role, thinking about how you bring different constituencies together within an organization or beyond an organization to an ecosystem in order to make fundamental change through data happen. But I think for me, the big differentiator is we're really focused on the who and the how as well as the what. And we're thinking about how can data and AI be applied to these problems in a meaningful but also a thoughtful way. It's not just about ad optimization and having some revenue hits. If you're doing something really important like distributing cash transfers to among the world's most low-income people, you want to make sure you get it right. So there's a lot of stakes to make sure you're serving.
For sure. And, you know, I was so inspired and just struck by the examples in the generative AI skills challenge that you just recently completed. Tell us a little bit about that. Like, what were you trying to accomplish with the challenge? Tell us a little bit about some of the participants and some of their stories, because I think they really kind of get at the heart of what this new field is all about.
First of all, thank you. We were thrilled to do the generative AI skills challenge in concert with Microsoft, because it was a real focus on how do we reskill, upskill people who are not traditionally in the technology field, who can think about using data and AI to solve problems, and generative AI in specific. So there's tremendous curiosity about it. I think we had something like 600 applications from 93 countries. So people were very engaged in the process. And a couple of the awardees really stood out for me. We had 5 stellar awardees, probably another 20 wonderful finalists. But the two that really stood out for me is one that Data Elevates is working with migrant Venezuelan women living in Chile to make sure that they have the skills that they need using generative AI to promote their career advancement, to give them skills so that they can work and integrate. And given all the climate conversations at the UN, General Assembly, there are just going to be more and more situations where, whether it's political challenges or climate issues, where you have refugees moving to different countries. And this was a wonderful opportunity to upskill and reskill these women and get them involved. They did it through a MOOC, a massively open online course, but also through plain old-fashioned matching of organizations to individuals looking for work. But a lot of the skill training was around generative AI and yielded terrific results in terms of employment, economic empowerment, and engagement in the local community. And secondly, the Maina Mihalla Foundation. So this is an organization that focuses on women's health in rural India. So Suhani Jalota is the wonderful founder, and she spoke actually at a breakfast we hosted at the UN General Assembly side event focused on how do we develop capacity in low and middle income countries for AI, for data. And she opened her remarks with 3 words, which are very taboo, but would be familiar to any woman who's dealt with her own health issues. What she does is she really focuses in on what are the kinds of questions women have about their own health, their own systems, and then how do they, using generative AI, how are they able to ask those questions when they might not even feel comfortable asking their sister or their best friend? And there is this intimacy about the interface that I think is really starting to crop up more and more. And again, there's an element of language here too, right? We want to be really focused on bringing more languages into generative AI, more languages into LLMs, because right now, most of it's in English or Mandarin. And that's a real problem, because you're missing a lot of local language, context, people, and people are getting excluded from the system. So what happens is people, they gather information about women's health. It is vetted by doctors, so it's checked for accuracy. And then women can ask questions about their own health. And then those questions then go on to feed more of the content that's generated for them. But to me, that's a real game-changing application of generative AI.
For sure. And, one of the things we talk about in technology a lot is this last mile problem is how do you actually get the technology to the people, or how do you get the service to the people or the product to the people? So what does the last mile problem look like in Chile for the Venezuelan immigrants? What does it look like in India for the Maina Mihalla Foundation? Like, how do you actually get the technology to people?
So it's interesting. A few years ago, we did a report called Recode, which was all about communities of color within the United States, funded by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. And this report was very focused on, what we wanted to do was engage with these communities of color to say, hey, how is data affecting your lives? What kind of your data should we use? What do you think? And basically they said, hold up, it starts with trust. We need to focus first on trust. Why do you think you have the right to our data? How are you going to use our data? Will we get our data back when you're all done with this? And I think our learning from the Recode report really influenced both the challenge awardees we selected and how we worked with them subsequently, because to solve the last mile problem, you need trust. You need engagement with local leaders. You need to intimately understand the problems. And you need to understand that the data ultimately belongs to the community you're trying to serve. And I think when you parachute in a solution from New York or San Francisco or London, and you designed it in your offices, and then you bring it, out to in country, and it's a miss, that's, you've broken the trust, right? You haven't co-designed and co-developed the solution along with the community. The last mile problem is solved by being embedded with the community, having them be part of the data selection, collection, analysis, and then to share in the results. And that's how you can make lasting last mile change.
What about the kind of practical task of actually getting these, the chatbot and the MOOC to people? Like, how do they actually access it?
In those cases, there were communities of people who were actually looking for the skills and training. So in the Venezuelan migrant situation, of course, it's a huge challenge. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it's profoundly affected life in Chile, life in Colombia, the number of Venezuelan migrants moving in. So I think there are existing community groups that are looking for ways to be helped in terms of integrating into society and, you know, being involved in financial inclusion, right? They want to be included in the local economy and engage. So I think that was the case in Venezuela. With the Mina Mejila Foundation, I think there are people on the ground who are really engaged in solving the problem and working through trusted mentors, whether those are local physicians who see perhaps women not attending to certain women's health issues that they need right away. And understanding the challenges around language, one example that Suhani Jalota offered at that breakfast was about understanding literally the language people are using, because a lot of these women were typing into this chatbot in the local language, how do I get an operation? Where's the operation? Who performs the operation? And no one quite understood outside of the local context what they meant was hysterectomy. So really being embedded with the physicians who then understand the challenges that they're facing is how you reach the last mile. And because you only reach the last mile if you're solving a real problem that people have, right?
For sure, for sure.
And as this technology, you're pushing your solution, but if it's not a real problem, you got to start with the problem.
So is this SMS? Is it phones? Is it, you know, community centers? Like, where are they going to get the information?
Depends on the context. A lot is community centers. And, you know, in several other of our challenge awardees, SMS has played a huge role. We worked with an awardee from our Inclusive Growth and Recovery Challenge a few years back that was developing cold chain storage solutions in India. And what they realized was they thought it would be a mobile app that the farmers would use. The farmers don't have the smartphones, but they were on SMS. So what they decided to do was to work with the cold chain storage managers who do have the smartphones, develop the app for them, and then the SMS went out. But in other instances, I know it's a combination of apps, SMS, and in one case, trucks with loudspeakers, right? You have to be very creative about reaching these communities.
Wow, that's amazing. You know, one of the things as I think about, you know, the cold chain versus the Mina Mejila, you know, women's health issue is that, like, you know, one thing people talk about with AI is, and with data is, like, you know, how can we use these technologies to actually recenter the human? And, you know, in the case of the women's health piece, it's not so much that you want that additional, quote, intimacy. It's that you want to take the intimacy and that personalization almost out of the equation so that somebody can get that information in a way that's neutral and in a way that's reflective of their own needs and their own kind of cultural context. And so in a sense, like, what's fascinating to me is that there are some places where we're looking at, you know, where AI can kind of automate some things, but this is a place where we're actually providing information to people that they need and that they can't necessarily get access to otherwise. And I think that's really fascinating.
Feel comfortable with, I think, is one point there. The intimacy isn't about human to human, but it's about what people will type into a chatbot, which I know from the veterans example, I know from the Mina Mejila Foundation example, and also I'm an advisor to, you know, a private sector startup in the HR space. And what they have found is what people will type in is perhaps far more disclosing and intimate than something they would have shared with an HR rep in person. Mm-hmm. So I think there's this element of engaging with a chatbot which brings up a whole responsible data and data privacy point, right?
Right.
These large unstructured blobs of personal data, we be thoughtful and mindful about how we use them.
For sure. And, you know, yes, a plug for anthropologists here who can kind of understand a little bit more about the cultural context of the data that we're talking about. But yes, I mean, this is incredibly sensitive data. It's intimate data. You need to keep that trust and secure that trust. So what are some of the processes that you go through in order to make sure that you do that, or that the different projects go through?
Well, we touched on this, but the idea of first starting with the community, you know, how do you engage them so you build the trust that you get the right data? I think you need good data governance in place and good processes and procedures that you put in place at the very beginning. And you need to do periodic checks. You know, what are the ways that you check that not only the data is secured properly, but that the, you know, the AI you're using, you know, is being checked for bias and being checked for hallucination. And all these are elements of responsible data. We actually launched a course on responsible data management that is now live with the government of Nigeria and the government of India. And in the latter, you know, we've worked with the Indian Capacity Building Commission to launch it on a platform that reaches 3.1 million federal civil servants and another 32 million when you spread it to state and local. And there's been a lot of interest in implementing responsible data at that level. The other thing we do is when we launch courses like that, there's a feedback loop, right? We understand what areas are clear, what areas are less clear, and that helps us to refine the curriculum and refine our recommendations for responsible data use. But it's hugely important and a big part of what we do.
That's great. And so you have that kind of flywheel effect where you're learning from what you're doing. And to me, one of the most interesting aspects of all of this is the co-creation, right? Is the co-creation of, in terms of understanding the problem, in terms of that kind of dialogue back and forth between the community and the building of the service, all of that is to me really fascinating. And especially when you think about, like, you know, learning as you go. I mean, one of the things we talk a lot about with technology, and particularly with data and AI, is that sort of idea of ideation, of that flywheel, of agile development. And essentially what you're doing is you're taking an agile development methodology and you're applying it to the public sector. What's fascinating to me about it too, though, is you know, when we spoke, I don't know, a little while ago, you talked about the three C's, and you talked about kind of how you approach these projects from a sort of more of a rigor standpoint, right? And so I'd love to dive into that a little bit. Like, let's talk about those three C's. As I remember, it's cases, capacity, and commons, right? So can you walk us through?
Sure. So cases are like use cases you would refer to in the private sector. What are some of the exemplars in the field? People doing remarkable work. They could be solving the same problem with different technologies or different problems using the same technologies, but they're really groundbreaking organizations that are using data and AI to solve social problems where they've thought about all the complexity, the interdisciplinary nature required, the responsible data practices needed, and how to measure impact effectively. So those are the cases we lead with. Secondly is capacity. How do we build? I mean, how does anyone build a field? And the answer is no one organization or person builds a field, right? It's a giant ecosystem of builders that we're just trying to capture the momentum of and share most broadly. So as an intermediary in the space, we try to take small examples, small curricular efforts, small, and spread them, you know, spread them globally so that people can benefit from the knowledge of others. So our capacity development is done through primarily through these hubs. We have five existing: India, the US, LATAM, across Africa, and as I mentioned, we'll be opening in APAC in November of this year with support from the MasterCard Center for Inclusive Growth. But we're very excited to be working on these hubs where we bring together just these wonderful universities who are developing curriculum and working with cohorts. And then also with social impact organizations who come in and engage with these students who are developing these data for social impact skills. Because I think a lot of times it's easy to get wrapped up on the supply side. Train, train, build, build, build. Who's going to hire these people, right? We have to make sure that the organizations are ready to bring in this kind of talent and know how to absorb it and know how to make the most of it. So really looking at it from a supply and a demand perspective on the capacity development. Also in capacity, we do digital learning work. As I mentioned, with India and Nigeria, we have a course in responsible data management that's launched this year. And the third sort of pillar is the commons. How do we think about ecosystems of digital public goods? And our primary example of this is the Epiverse Initiative, which is an ecosystem of data analysis tools focused on preventing the next pandemic or next epidemic. And Epiverse looks back at the pandemic and all those tools that were created or duplicates or abandoned, and thinks about how do we create a suite of interoperable digital public goods and work together. And that's an initiative we're nurturing in support of a broader Epiverse community globally. So cases, capacity, commons is how we do our work. But really, the real answer to how we do our work is with partners. We have tremendous partners all around the globe, whether that's philanthropy, private sector, social impact organizations, and academia, was really sort of edging their way toward applied in a lot of these fields.
So I love this idea of cases, capacity, and commons. And you know what's so funny to me about it, or so interesting to me about it, is that, you know, it makes perfect sense for the public sector, but it also makes sense for the private sector, right? In the private sector, in business, we talk about use cases, we talk about readiness, whether it's data readiness, AI readiness, whatever it might be, cloud, you know, preparedness, all those things. And then the commons are really, they're just, they're resources, they're shared resources, developer communities and all of that. And so these kinds of new method, I would say adapted methodologies, and in some cases, brand new methodologies are so important And so important to share across public and private sector projects, I think. And which gets me sort of to the question of impact, right? Because I think one of the things that's been really interesting to watch throughout the last couple of years is that, you know, because we're all learning as we go, we don't necessarily have norms for what the impact of projects should necessarily look like. Sometimes the impact is, well, we learn something. We learn something really important, and we're going to take that and plow it into the next project. How do you think about that at data.org?
Yeah, you're reminding me of the shift of waterfall to agile back in the 90s, right? Better phase to add, you know, to go from
exactly.
Did something work or not was much clearer before you were doing sprints. I'd say impact is just notoriously slippery. You know, it's a Justice Potter Stewart said, you know it when you see it. About a very different topic, but I think impact's a little bit like that. I think there are obvious impact metrics that you can tie to goals. For our $10 million Inclusive Growth and Recovery Challenge, for example, we worked with an organization called Community Lattice, and they were focused on brownfields redevelopment, polluted, underused areas in cities that could be turned into something else. So you could absolutely look at communities engaged, governments partners with, actual properties that were, you know, turned into something useful in the community, and then economic empowerment and financial inclusion for people who went on to use those properties. So those are sort of obvious metrics that are tied to goals. I think where it gets really tricky is where funders, whether that's philanthropy or private sector, are looking for that one number to rule them all, to take apples to apples, you know, when really you have apples and, you know, dragon fruit sometimes. Two very different things that you're trying to compare. And I think if you have a portfolio of grantees, of course, it makes perfect sense. You want to know who's an A student, who's a B student, who's a C student. But I think the answer, unfortunately, a lot of contexts is it depends. You have to get pretty deep into the subject matter to see what's working. And then the secondary funding concern around impact is, can it scale, right?
Yeah,
when we do
absolutely.
These challenges, some of these solutions will scale in very obvious ways. Some will not scale readily, but we'll touch upon a problem or a way to solve a problem that could be very useful to another one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, again, like thinking back to, you know, reading, because I did, the analytics blog people over the course of the last, I don't even want to say how many years, you know, that idea of one metric to rule them all, it doesn't work anywhere, right? Because you're always missing context. And data, and particularly unstructured data and AI, it's all about context, right? It's all about, did you have the impact you expected? Did you have impact over and above that? Was there something else going on? You know, did you underperform in the way that you expected to, but overperform somewhere else? And I think my sense is, anyway, that these metrics, these measurements will evolve, but fundamentally it's about, did you affect people in a positive way, in a way that can continue and grow over time? Because I think, you know, scale is critical no matter what you're talking about.
Overweight on one metric, excuse me, if you overweight on one metric, people will just work to that one metric. That'll be
yes.
The answer, right? So
yes.
You say to a nonprofit distributing, you know, clean energy products in sub-Saharan Africa, you know, we're going to judge you by the number of products you sell. Well, they're going to sell less expensive, higher volume products. And that might not be what the community needs. And I think there's so many similarities, as you pointed out, Susan, between the social sector and the private sector. This is an essential difference, right? Mm. This is really to pay attention to. It's not the number of jeans sold that will, you know, make a retailer's number. You have to look at, is what we're incentivizing the local organization to do the right thing for the local community and context?
Yeah, I bet a lot of leaders in the business community would say, absolutely, it's the exact same thing for us, right? We want to incentivize the right behaviors. We want to make sure that people are going after the outcomes that we want, not the outcomes that we necessarily somehow ended up, you know, measuring by default. So, you know, I'm wondering, in all of this work, you know, you came to it after a career, you know, that has, you know, spanned so many different areas. And really, I think, as everybody who's in this world right now, like, we're all sort of feeling our way along. Were there any surprises for you? Any things that you, like, kind of look back and say, oh, gosh, I wish we did this way? Or just things that you thought were kind of, just, I don't know, interesting to note for people, because I think one of the things that people really miss, and a lot of the reason that this podcast exists, is like, what was that, you know, what can I learn from other people's experience that I can apply in my own world?
Well, someone who's worked her whole career to be very focused on sort of results and efficiency and delivery. I think I really underemphasized trust and proximity. And that's been a big learning throughout my career, how important it is to be close to the problem that you're trying to solve. Mm. And just you spend a lot of time up front on whether that's user interviews or market research and analysis to feel like you're closer to it, to understand it more deeply. And the element of trust, right? You can build the most efficient engine in the world, but if no one believes you're a good engine builder, you're not going to make a lot of progress. So I think that's probably been the biggest surprise overall. I will say there have been many wonderful and positive surprises, which is when we launched these challenges or these capacity accelerator hubs, the creativity and the energy people bring to solving problems. People in tremendously low resource areas are, if there's no internet, we're going to find this magic workaround with a thumb drive. There's just constant creativity brought about by constraint that I think we can all learn from.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, that leads me to this question of what advice you have for leaders as, you know, as we all, you know, there's so few opportunities in our lives to stop and take stock, but let's just take a second and take stock. You know, what advice do you have for other leaders, be they in the public sector, in the private sector, in government, wherever they are, in terms of data and AI? What have you learned that you can share with our listeners?
I'd have to say that my advice for leaders, regardless of what sector they sit in, is, you know, don't be afraid to dip in, right? I think there's a little bit of hesitance. See, if you didn't grow up with these technologies, which I guess none of us did, but I think the most important thing is to be bold, to experiment, to find ways to incorporate data and AI into your line of business or to your work in small, incremental, low-risk ways so that you can be prepared for when there's a greater necessity for adaptation throughout. I have some concerns that some leaders are holding back a little bit, sort of waiting to see how AI pans out. Is this going to be another NFT, right? Is this going to be another flash in the pan technology that every intern tells me I have to learn? And then, you know, it ends up being, you know, not a primary concern for me. But I think AI is here. It's here to stay. It's very important that we think about what are some of the ways we adapt to this new world. There are concerns. There are risks. But I think ultimately, adaptation is a very hopeful act, right? Learning and adaptation to an era of AI is something I think we all have to do. And, you know, this is just sort of a general leadership point, but find the leaders in your organization who are doing this work. It may not be, you know, the person on the org chart with the title you would expect, but there will be people who are experimenting, learning, doing through AI. That might be through fashion. That might be through healthcare. And finding those people and learning from them is a real power move.
Adaptation is a really hopeful act. I think that is my favorite sentence of the day. Perry, thank you so, so much. It's been such a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you so much, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
Wow. Okay. So three takeaways from our conversation. First, the emphasis on co-creation as a way to build trust. It's not only about the trustworthiness of what you're building, but as Perry says, the who and the how. And that means centering on the people you are building for rather than the tech and recognizing that the expertise sits with them. And that means a hard look at process and some significant self-awareness too. Second, we talk about the last mile problem in technology a lot, but usually as an issue of logistics. How do you deliver object A to person B at point C in the most efficient way? But Perry brought up so many other ways to think about that last mile. It's not only about the mechanics of delivery, but making sure people want to receive it and can receive it. And what really resonated for me is the absolute humility required to make those choices, whether the tech is wrapped in the most sophisticated digital app you can imagine or on a truck with a loudspeaker. Third, don't be afraid. None of us grew up with these technologies, so we're all figuring it out together. And as Perry said, adaptation is a hopeful act. We hope you've enjoyed this first episode of Leading the Shift. And as I'm sure you know, new podcasts live and die on engagement. So please like, comment, share, tell your friends, and let us know what you'd like to hear about in future episodes. If you'd like to learn more about how people and organizations are innovating with Microsoft Azure, Visit azure.microsoft.com.